Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Epilogue, Part 1. Siberia. On the banks of a broad, solitary river stands a town, one of the administrative centers of Russia. In the town there is a fortress. In the fortress there is a prison. In the prison, the second-class convict, Rodion Raskolnikov, has been confined for 9 months. Almost a year and a half has passed since his crime. There had been little difficulty about his trial. The criminal adhered exactly, firmly, and clearly to his statement. He did not confuse, nor misrepresent the facts, nor soften them in his own interest, nor omit the smallest detail. He explained every incident of the murder, the secret of the pledge, the piece of wood with a strip of metal, which was found in the murdered woman's hand. He described minutely how he had taken her keys, what they were like, as well as the chest and its contents. He explained the mystery of Lizaveta's murder, described how Kotz and, after him, the student knocked and repeated all they had said to one another, how he afterwards had run downstairs and heard Nikolay and Dmitri shouting, how he had hidden in the empty flat and afterwards gone home. He ended by indicating the stone in the yard off the Voznesensky Prospect, under which the purse and the trinkets were found. The whole thing, in fact, was perfectly clear. The lawyers and the judges were very much struck, among other things, by the fact that he had hidden the trinkets and the purse under a stone without making use of them, and that, what was more, he did not now remember what the trinkets were like, or even how many there were. The fact that he had never opened the purse and did not even know how much was in it seemed incredible. There turned out to be in the purse 317 rubles and 60 kopecks. From being so long under the stone, some of the most valuable notes lying uppermost had suffered from the damp. They were a long while trying to discover why the accused man should tell a lie about this, when about everything else he had made a truthful and straightforward confession. Finally, some of the lawyers more versed in psychology admitted that it was possible he had really not looked into the purse, and so he didn't know what was in it when he hid it under the stone. But they immediately drew the deduction that the crime could only have been committed through temporary mental derangement, through homicidal mania, without object or the pursuit of gain. This fell in with the most recent fashionable theory of temporary insanity, so often applied in our days in criminal cases. Moreover, Raskolnikov's hypochondriacal condition was proved by many witnesses, by Dr. Zosimov, his former fellow students, his landlady and her servant. All this pointed strongly to the conclusion that Raskolnikov was not quite like an ordinary murderer and robber, but that there was another element in the case. To the intense annoyance of those who maintained this opinion, the criminal scarcely attempted to defend himself. To the decisive question as to what motive impelled him to the murder and the robbery, he answered very clearly, with the coarsest frankness, that the cause was his miserable position, his poverty and helplessness, and his desire to provide for his first steps in life by the help of the 3,000 rubles he had reckoned on finding. He had been led to the murder through his shallow and cowardly nature, exasperated moreover by privation and failure. To the question what led him to confess, he answered that it was his heartfelt repentance. All this was almost coarse. The sentence, however, was more merciful than could have been expected, perhaps partly because the criminal had not tried to justify himself, but had rather shown a desire to exaggerate his guilt. All the strange and peculiar circumstances of the crime were taken into consideration. There could be no doubt of the abnormal and poverty-stricken condition of the criminal at the time. The fact that he had made no use of what he had stolen was put down partly to the effect of remorse, partly to his abnormal mental condition at the time of the crime. Incidentally, the murder of Lizaveta served indeed to confirm the last hypothesis. A man commits 2 murders and forgets that the door is open. Finally, the confession, at the very moment when the case was hopelessly muddled by the false evidence given by Nikolay through melancholy and fanaticism, and when, moreover, there were no proofs against the real criminal, no suspicions even. Porfiry Petrovich fully kept his word. All this did much to soften the sentence. Other circumstances, too, in the prisoner's favor, came out quite unexpectedly. Razumihin somehow discovered and proved that while Raskolnikov was at the university, he had helped a poor, consumptive fellow student and had spent his last penny on supporting him for 6 months, and when this student died, leaving a decrepit old father whom he had maintained almost from his 13th year, Raskolnikov had got the old man into a hospital and paid for his funeral when he died. Raskolnikov's landlady bore witness, too, that when they had lived in another house at Five Corners, Raskolnikov had rescued two little children from a house on fire and was burnt in doing so. This was investigated and fairly well confirmed by many witnesses. These facts made an impression in his favor. And in the end, the criminal was, in consideration of extenuating circumstances, condemned to penal servitude in the second class for a term of 8 years only. At the very beginning of the trial, Raskolnikov's mother fell ill. Dunya and Razumihin found it possible to get her out of Petersburg during the trial. Razumihin chose a town on the railway not far from Petersburg so as to be able to follow every step of the trial and at the same time to see Avdotya Romanovna as often as possible. Pulcheria Alexandrovna's illness was a strange, nervous one and was accompanied by a partial derangement of her intellect. When Dunya returned from her last interview with her brother, she had found her mother already ill, in feverish delirium. That evening, Razumihin and she agreed what answers they must make to her mother's questions about Raskolnikov, and made up a complete story for his mother's benefit of his having to go away to a distant part of Russia on a business commission which would bring him in the end money and reputation. But they were struck by the fact that Pulcheria Alexandrovna never asked them anything on the subject, neither then nor thereafter. On the contrary, she had her own version of her son's sudden departure. She told them with tears how he had come to say goodbye to her, hinting that she alone knew many mysterious and important facts, and that Rodya had many very powerful enemies, so that it was necessary for him to be in hiding. As for his future career, she had no doubt that it would be brilliant when certain sinister influences could be removed. She assured Razumihin that her son would one day be a very great statesman, that his article and brilliant literary talent proved it. This article she was continually reading. She even read it aloud, almost took it to bed with her, but scarcely asked where Rodya was, though the subject was obviously avoided by the others, which might have been enough to awaken her suspicions. They began to be frightened at last in Pulcheria Alexandrovna's strange silence on certain subjects. She did not, for instance, complain of getting no letters from him, though in previous years she had only lived on the hope of letters from her beloved Rodya. This was the cause of great uneasiness to Dunya. The idea occurred to her that her mother suspected that there was something terrible in her son's fate, and was afraid to ask for fear of hearing something still more awful. In any case, Dunya saw clearly that her mother was not in full possession of her faculties. It happened once or twice, however, that Pulcheria Alexandrovna gave such a turn to the conversation that it was impossible to answer her without mentioning where Rodya was, and on receiving unsatisfactory and suspicious answers, she became at once gloomy and silent, and this mood lasted for a long time. Dunya saw at last that it was hard to deceive her, and came to the conclusion that it was better to be absolutely silent on certain points, but it became more and more evident that the poor mother suspected something terrible. Dunya remembered her brothers telling her that her mother had overheard her talking in her sleep on the night after her interview with Svidrigailov, and before the fatal day of the confession. Had not she made out something from that? Sometimes days and even weeks of gloomy silence and tears would be succeeded by a period of hysterical animation, and the invalid would begin to talk almost incessantly of her son, of her hopes of his future. Her fancies were sometimes very strange. They humored her, pretended to agree with her. She saw perhaps that they were pretending, but she still went on talking. 5 months after Raskolnikov's confession, he was sentenced. Razumihin and Sonya saw him in prison as often as it was possible. At last, the moment of separation came. Dunya swore to her brother that the separation should not be forever. Razumihin did the same. Razumihin, in his youthful ardor, had firmly resolved to lay the foundations at least of a secure livelihood during the next 3 or 4 years, and saving up a certain sum to emigrate to Siberia, a country rich in every natural resource, and in need of workers, active men, and capital. There, they would settle in the town where Rodya was, and all together would begin a new life. They all wept at parting. Raskolnikov had been very dreamy for a few days before. He asked a great deal about his mother, and was constantly anxious about her. He worried so much about her that it alarmed Dunya. When he heard about his mother's illness, he became very gloomy. With Sonya, he was particularly reserved all the time. With the help of the money left to her by Svidrigaïlov, Sonya had long ago made her preparations to follow the party of convicts in which he was dispatched to Siberia. Not a word passed between Raskolnikov and her on the subject, but both knew it would be so. At the final leave-taking, he smiled strangely at his sisters and Razumihin's fervent anticipations of their happy future together when he should come out of prison. He predicted that their mother's illness would soon have a fatal ending. Sonya and he at last set off. 2 months later, Dunya was married to Razumihin. It was a quiet and sorrowful wedding. Porfiry Petrovich and Zosimov were invited, however. During all this period, Razumihin wore an air of resolute determination. Dunya put implicit faith in his carrying out his plans, and indeed she could not but believe in him. He displayed a rare strength of will. Among other things, he began attending university lectures again in order to take his degree. They were continually making plans for the future. Both counted on settling in Siberia within 5 years at least. Till then, they rested their hopes on Sonya. Pulcheria Alexandrovna was delighted to give her blessing to Dunya's marriage with Razumihin, but after the marriage she became even more melancholy and anxious. To give her pleasure, Razumihin told her how Raskolnikov had looked after the poor student and his decrepit father, and how a year ago he had been burnt and injured in rescuing two little children from a fire. These two pieces of news excited Pulcheria Alexandrovna's disordered imagination almost to ecstasy. She was continually talking about them, even entering into conversations with strangers in the street, though Dunya always accompanied her. In public conveyances and shops, wherever she could capture a listener, she would begin the discourse about her son, his article, how he had helped the student, how he had been burnt at the fire, and so on. Dunya did not know how to restrain her. Apart from the danger of her morbid excitement, there was the risk of someone's recalling Raskolnikov's name and speaking of the recent trial. Pulcheria Alexandrovna found out the address of the mother of the two children her son had saved and insisted on going to see her. At last, her restlessness reached an extreme point. She would sometimes begin to cry suddenly, and was often ill and feverishly delirious. One morning she declared that, by her reckoning, Rodya ought soon to be home, that she remembered when he said good-bye to her, he said that they must expect him back in 9 months. She began to prepare for his coming, began to do up her room for him, to clean the furniture, to wash and put up new hangings, and so on. Dunya was anxious, but said nothing, and helped her to arrange the room. After a fatiguing day spent in continual fancies, in joyful daydreams and tears, Pulcheria Alexandrovna was taken ill in the night, and by morning she was feverish and delirious. It was brain fever. She died within a fortnight. In her delirium, she dropped words which showed that she knew a great deal more about her son's terrible fate than they had supposed. For a long time Raskolnikov did not know of his mother's death, though regular correspondence had been maintained from the time he reached Siberia. It was carried on by means of Sonya, who wrote every month to the Razumihins and received an answer with unfailing regularity. At first they found Sonya's letters dry and unsatisfactory, but later on they came to the conclusion that the letters could not be better, for from these letters they received a complete picture of their unfortunate brother's life. Sonya's letters were full of the most matter-of-fact detail, the simplest and clearest description of all Raskolnikov's surroundings as a convict. There was no word of her own hopes, no conjecture as to the future, no description of her feelings. Instead of any attempt to interpret his state of mind and inner life, she gave the simple facts, that is, his own words, an exact account of his health, what he asked for at their interviews, what commission he gave her, and so on. All these facts she gave with extraordinary minuteness. The picture of their unhappy brother stood out at last with great clearness and precision. There could be no mistake, because nothing was given but facts. But Dunya and her husband could get little comfort out of the news, especially at first. Sonya wrote that he was constantly sullen and not ready to talk, that he scarcely seemed interested in the news she gave him from their letters, that he sometimes asked after his mother, and that, when seeing that he had guessed the truth, she told him at last of her death, she was surprised to find that he did not seem greatly affected by it. Not externally, at any rate. She told them that, although he seemed so wrapped up in himself and, as it were, shut himself off from everyone, he took a very direct and simple view of his new life, that he understood his position, expected nothing better for the time, had no ill-founded hopes, as is so common in his position, and scarcely seemed surprised at anything in his surroundings so unlike anything he had known before. She wrote that his health was satisfactory. He did his work without shirking or seeking to do more. He was almost indifferent about food, but except on Sundays and holidays, the food was so bad that, at last, he had been glad to accept some money from her, Sonya, to have his own tea every day. He begged her not to trouble about anything else, declaring that all this fuss about him only annoyed him. Sonya wrote further that in prison he shared the same room with the rest, that she had not seen the inside of their barracks, but concluded that they were crowded, miserable, and unhealthy, that he slept on a plank bed with a rug under him, and was unwilling to make any other arrangement, but that he lived so poorly and roughly, not from any plan or design, but simply from inattention and indifference. Sonya wrote simply that he had at first shown no interest in her visits, had almost been vexed with her indeed for coming, unwilling to talk and rude to her, but that in the end these visits had become a habit, and almost a necessity for him, so that he was positively distressed when she was ill for some days and could not visit him. She used to see him on holidays at the prison gates, or in the guard-room, to which he was brought for a few minutes to see her. On working days she would go to see him at work, either at the workshops, or at the brick kilns, or at the sheds on the banks of the Irtysh. About herself, Sonya wrote that she had succeeded in making some acquaintances in the town, that she did sewing, and, as there was scarcely a dressmaker in the town, she was looked upon as an indispensable person in many houses. But she did not mention that the authorities were, through her, interested in Raskolnikov, that his task was lightened, and so on. At last the news came. Dunya had indeed noticed signs of alarm and uneasiness in the preceding letters, that he held aloof from everyone, that his fellow prisoners did not like him, that he kept silent for days at a time, and was becoming very pale. In the last letter, Sonya wrote that he had been taken very seriously ill and was in the convict ward of the hospital. Epilogue 2. He was ill a long time, but it was not the horrors of prison life, not the hard labor, the bad food, the shaven head, or the patched clothes that crushed him. What did he care for all those trials and hardships? He was even glad of the hard work. Physically exhausted, he could at least reckon on a few hours of quiet sleep. And what was the food to him? The thin cabbage soup with beetles floating in it. In the past, as a student, he had often not had even that. His clothes were warm and suited to his manner of life. He did not even feel the fetters. Was he ashamed of his shaven head and party-colored coat? Before whom? Before Sonya. Sonya was afraid of him. How could he be ashamed before her? And yet he was ashamed even before Sonya, whom he tortured because of it with his contemptuous, rough manner. But it was not his shaven head and his fetters he was ashamed of. His pride had been stung to the quick. It was wounded pride that made him ill. Oh, how happy he would have been if he could have blamed himself. He could have borne anything then, even shame and disgrace. But he judged himself severely, and his exasperated conscience found no particularly terrible fault in his past except a simple blunder which might happen to anyone. He was ashamed just because he, Raskolnikov, had so hopelessly, stupidly come to grief through some decree of blind fate and must humble himself and submit to the idiocy of a sentence if he were anyhow to be at peace. Vague and objectless anxiety in the present, and in the future a continual sacrifice leading to nothing, that was all that lay before him. And what comfort was it to him that at the end of 8 years he would only be 32 and able to begin a new life? What had he to live for? What had he to look forward to? Why should he strive? To live in order to exist? Why, he had been ready 1,000 times before to give up existence for the sake of an idea, for a hope, even for a fancy. Mere existence had always been too little for him. He had always wanted more. Perhaps it was just because of the strength of his desires that he had thought himself a man to whom more was permissible than to others. And if only fate would have sent him repentance, burning repentance that would have torn his heart and robbed him of sleep, that repentance, the awful agony of which brings visions of hanging or drowning, oh, he would have been glad of it. Tears and agonies would at least have been life. But he did not repent of his crime. At least he might have found relief in raging at his stupidity, as he had raged at the grotesque blunders that had brought him to prison. But now, in prison, in freedom, he thought over and criticized all his actions again, and by no means found them so blundering and so grotesque as they had seemed at the fatal time. "In what way," he asked himself, "was my theory stupider than others that have swarmed and clashed from the beginning of the world? One has only to look at the thing quite independently, broadly, and uninfluenced by commonplace ideas, and my idea will by no means seem so strange. Oh, skeptics and halfpenny philosophers, why do you halt halfway? Why does my action strike them as so horrible?" he said to himself. "Is it because it was a crime? What is meant by crime? My conscience is at rest. Of course, it was a legal crime. Of course, the letter of the law was broken and blood was shed. Well, punish me for the letter of the law, and that's enough. Of course, in that case, many of the benefactors of mankind who snatched power for themselves instead of inheriting it ought to have been punished at the first steps. But those men succeeded, and so they were right, and I didn't, and so I had no right to have taken that step." It was only in that he recognized his criminality, only in the fact that he had been unsuccessful and had confessed it. He suffered, too, from the question, why had he not killed himself? Why had he stood looking at the river and preferred to confess? Was the desire to live so strong, and was it so hard to overcome it? Had not Svidrigaïlov overcome it, although he was afraid of death? In misery, he asked himself this question, and could not understand that, at the very time he had been standing looking into the river, he had perhaps been dimly conscious of the fundamental falsity in himself and his convictions. He didn't understand that that consciousness might be the promise of a future crisis, of a new view of life and of his future resurrection. He preferred to attribute it to the dead weight of instinct, which he could not step over, again through weakness and meanness. He looked at his fellow prisoners and was amazed to see how they all loved life and prized it. It seemed to him that they loved and valued life more in prison than in freedom. What terrible agonies and privations some of them, the tramps, for instance, had endured. Could they care so much for a ray of sunshine, for the primeval forest, the cold spring hidden away in some unseen spot which the tramp had marked 3 years before and longed to see again, as he might to see his sweetheart, dreaming of the green grass round it and the bird singing in the bush? As he went on, he saw still more inexplicable examples. In prison, of course, there was a great deal he did not see and did not want to see. He lived, as it were, with downcast eyes. It was loathsome and unbearable for him to look. But in the end, there was much that surprised him, and he began, as it were, involuntarily, to notice much that he had not suspected before. What surprised him most of all was the terrible, impossible gulf that lay between him and all the rest. They seemed to be a different species, and he looked at them, and they at him, with distrust and hostility. He felt anew the reasons of his isolation, but he would never have admitted till then that those reasons were so deep and strong. There were some Polish exiles, political prisoners among them. They simply looked down upon all the rest as ignorant churls, but Raskolnikov could not look upon them like that. He saw that these ignorant men were in many respects far wiser than the Poles. There were some Russians who were just as contemptuous, a former officer and two seminarists. Raskolnikov saw their mistake as clearly. He was disliked and avoided by everyone. They even began to hate him at last. Why, he could not tell. Men who had been far more guilty despised and laughed at his crime. "You're a gentleman," they used to say. "You shouldn't hack about with an axe. That's not a gentleman's work." The second week in Lent, his turn came to take the sacrament with his gang. He went to church and prayed with the others. A quarrel broke out one day. He did not know how. All fell on him at once in a fury. "You're an infidel. You don't believe in God," they shouted. "You ought to be killed." He had never talked to them about God, nor his belief, but they wanted to kill him as an infidel. He said nothing. One of the prisoners rushed at him in a perfect frenzy. Raskolnikov awaited him calmly and silently. His eyebrows did not quiver, his face did not flinch. The guard succeeded in intervening between him and his assailant, or they would have been bloodshed. There was another question he could not decide. Why were they all so fond of Sonya? She did not try to win their favor. She rarely met them. Sometimes only she came to see him at work for a moment, and yet everybody knew her. They knew that she had come out to follow him, knew how and where she lived. She never gave them money, did them no particular services. Only once at Christmas she sent them all presents of pies and rolls. But by degrees, closer relations sprang up between them and Sonya. She would write and post letters for them to their relations. Relations of the prisoners who visited the town, at their instructions, left with Sonya presents and money for them. Their wives and sweethearts knew her and used to visit her. And when she visited Raskolnikov at work or met a party of the prisoners on the road, they all took off their hats to her.
"Little mother, Sofya Semyonovna, you are our dear, good little mother,"
coarse-branded criminals said to that frail little creature. She would smile and bow to them, and everyone was delighted when she smiled. They even admired her gait and turned round to watch her walking. They admired her, too, for being so little, and, in fact, did not know what to admire her most for. They even came to her for help in their illnesses. He was in the hospital from the middle of Lent till after Easter. When he was better, he remembered the dreams he had had while he was feverish and delirious. He dreamt that the whole world was condemned to a terrible, new, strange plague that had come to Europe from the depths of Asia. All were to be destroyed except a very few chosen. Some new sorts of microbes were attacking the bodies of men. But these microbes were endowed with intelligence and will. Men attacked by them became at once mad and furious. But never had men considered themselves so intellectual and so completely in possession of the truth as these sufferers. Never had they considered their decisions, their scientific conclusions, their moral convictions so infallible. Whole villages, whole towns and peoples went mad from the infection. All were excited and did not understand one another. Each thought that he alone had the truth, and was wretched looking at the others, beat himself on the breast, wept, and wrung his hands. They did not know how to judge, and could not agree what to consider evil and what good. They did not know whom to blame, whom to justify. Men killed each other in a sort of senseless spite. They gathered together in armies against one another, but even on the march the armies would begin attacking each other. The ranks would be broken, and the soldiers would fall on each other, stabbing and cutting, biting and devouring each other. The alarm bell was ringing all day long in the towns. Men rushed together. But why they were summoned, and who was summoning them, no one knew. The most ordinary trades were abandoned because everyone proposed his own ideas, his own improvements, and they could not agree. The land, too, was abandoned. Men met in groups, agreed on something, swore to keep together, but at once began on something quite different from what they had proposed. They accused one another, fought and killed each other. There were conflagrations and famine. All men and all things were involved in destruction. The plague spread and moved further and further. Only a few men could be saved in the whole world. They were a pure, chosen people, destined to found a new race and a new life, to renew and purify the earth. But no one had seen these men. No one had heard their words and their voices. Raskolnikov was worried that this senseless dream haunted his memory so miserably, the impression of this feverish delirium persisted so long. The second week after Easter had come. There were warm, bright spring days. In the prison ward, the grating windows under which the sentinel paced were opened. Sonya had only been able to visit him twice during his illness. Each time, she had to obtain permission, and it was difficult. But she often used to come to the hospital yard, especially in the evening, sometimes only to stand a minute and look up at the windows of the ward. One evening, when he was almost well again, Raskolnikov fell asleep. On waking up, he chanced to go to the window, and at once saw Sonya in the distance at the hospital gate. She seemed to be waiting for someone. Something stabbed him to the heart at that minute. He shuddered and moved away from the window. Next day, Sonya did not come, nor the day after. He noticed that he was expecting her uneasily. At last he was discharged. On reaching the prison, he learnt from the convicts that Sofya Semyonovna was lying ill at home and was unable to go out. He was very uneasy, and sent to inquire after her. He soon learnt that her illness was not dangerous. Hearing that he was anxious about her, Sonya sent him a penciled note, telling him that she was much better, that she had a slight cold, and that she would soon, very soon, come and see him at his work. His heart throbbed painfully as he read it. Again, it was a warm, bright day. Early in the morning, at 6 o'clock, he went off to work on the riverbank, where they used to pound alabaster, and where there was a kiln for baking it in a shed. There were only three of them sent. One of the convicts went with the guard to the fortress to fetch a tool. The other began getting the wood ready and laying it in the kiln. Raskolnikov came out of the shed onto the riverbank, sat down on a heap of logs by the shed, and began gazing at the wide, deserted river. From the high bank, a broad landscape opened before him. The sound of singing floated faintly audible from the other bank. In the vast steppe, bathed in sunshine, he could just see, like black specks, the nomads' tents. There was freedom. There, other men were living, utterly unlike those here. There, time itself seemed to stand still, as though the age of Abraham and his flocks had not passed. Raskolnikov sat gazing. His thoughts passed into daydreams, into contemplation. He thought of nothing but a vague restlessness excited and troubled him. Suddenly, he found Sonya beside him. She had come up noiselessly and sat down at his side. It was still quite early. The morning chill was still keen. She wore her poor old burnous and the green shawl. Her face still showed signs of illness. It was thinner and paler. She gave him a joyful smile of welcome, but held out her hand with her usual timidity. She was always timid of holding out her hand to him, and sometimes did not offer it at all, as though afraid he would repel it. He always took her hand as though with repugnance, always seemed vexed to meet her, and was sometimes obstinately silent throughout her visit. Sometimes she trembled before him and went away deeply grieved. But now their hands did not part. He stole a rapid glance at her and dropped his eyes on the ground without speaking. They were alone. No one had seen them. The guard had turned away for the time. How it happened, he did not know, but all at once something seemed to seize him and fling him at her feet. He wept and threw his arms round her knees. For the first instant she was terribly frightened, and she turned pale. She jumped up and looked at him, trembling. But at the same moment she understood, and a light of infinite happiness came into her eyes. She knew and had no doubt that he loved her beyond everything, and that at last the moment had come. They wanted to speak, but could not. Tears stood in their eyes. They were both pale and thin, but those pale, sick faces were bright with the dawn of a new future, of a full resurrection into a new life. They were renewed by love. The heart of each held infinite sources of life for the heart of the other. They resolved to wait and be patient. They had another 7 years to wait, and what terrible suffering and what infinite happiness before them. But he had risen again, and he knew it and felt it in all his being, while she only lived in his life. On the evening of the same day, when the barracks were locked, Raskolnikov lay on his plank bed and thought of her. He'd even fancied that day that all the convicts who had been his enemies looked at him differently. He had even entered into talk with them, and they answered him in a friendly way. He remembered that now, and thought it was bound to be so. Wasn't everything now bound to be changed? He thought of her. He remembered how continually he had tormented her and wounded her heart. He remembered her pale and thin little face. But these recollections scarcely troubled him now. He knew with what infinite love he would now repay all her sufferings, and what were all the agonies of the past, everything, even his crime, his sentence and imprisonment, seemed to him now, in the first rush of feeling, an external strange fact with which he had no concern. But he could not think for long together of anything that evening, and he could not have analyzed anything consciously. He was simply feeling. Life had stepped into the place of theory, and something quite different would work itself out in his mind. Under his pillow lay the New Testament. He took it up mechanically. The book belonged to Sonya. It was the one from which she had read the raising of Lazarus to him. At first he was afraid that she would worry him about religion, would talk about the gospel, and pester him with books. But to his great surprise, she had not once approached the subject, and had not even offered him the testament. He had asked her for it himself, not long before his illness, and she brought him the book without a word. Till now he had not opened it. He did not open it now, but one thought passed through his mind. Can her convictions not be mine now? Her feelings, her aspirations at least. She, too, had been greatly agitated that day, and at night she was taken ill again, but she was so happy and so unexpectedly happy that she was almost frightened of her happiness. 7 years! Only 7 years! At the beginning of their happiness, at some moments, they were both ready to look on those 7 years as though they were 7 days. He did not know that the new life would not be given him for nothing, that he would have to pay dearly for it, that it would cost him great striving, great suffering. But that is the beginning of a new story, the story of the gradual renewal of a man, the story of his gradual regeneration, of his passing from one world into another, of his initiation into a new, unknown life. That might be the subject of a new story, but our present story is ended. The end of Epilogue 2 and the end of Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go. On the web at fcit.usf.edu.